talk over me.
I'm going to have to start by asking everyone to forgive me. I'm a little bit under the weather, and my voice is less than perfect. So I'll do my best. Thankfully, it's a small room, but I'll probably have to be doing a lot of drinking in the middle. I'm very pleased to be participating in today's program, which, as we already heard, highlights halakhic issues related to the Beis Din process. My own presentation focuses on how Beis Din litigation is viewed by United States law. But in an important way, these two issues are linked. The fact that there is increased use of Batei Din now, ensuring increased compliance with the Israel Post, is attributable, at least in part, to how hospitable the United States legal system is to religious arbitration. Indeed, the very notion that United States courts will recognize, confirm, and enforce Piskei Din is quite radical. Conversely, there is a strong sense abroad that religious arbitration poses a threat to the nation state by encouraging participants to reject state law and instead choose religious law to govern their disputes. For example, on September 11, 2005, the Premier of Ontario, Dalton McGuinty, announced that his government would pursue legislation to outlaw faith-based arbitration in the family law context. Responding to requests from the Muslim community to allow Sharia courts to render binding family law decisions, McGuinty proclaimed, quote, "There will be no religious arbitration in Ontario. There will be one law for all Ontarians." The very next year, Ontario passed the Family Statute Law Amendment Act, which prohibits faith-based family law arbitration. On the other side of the Atlantic, in a lecture delivered on February 7, 2008, the Archbishop of Canterbury called for the integration of Sharia courts into the British legal system through religious arbitration. In response to this mere suggestion, politicians not only denounced the speech, but also called for the Archbishop's resignation. By contrast, religious arbitration is alive and well in the United States. Parties can choose to have their disputes adjudicated through Christian conciliation, Sharia courts, and most prominently, Batei Din. Moreover, under United States law, if the right procedures are followed, the decisions issued by such religious tribunals can become legally enforceable. Today I'm going to discuss Beis Din litigation, focusing on the following two questions. First, how is it that a Psak Din issued by a Beis Din can be, from the perspective of United States law, legally enforceable? And second, what is the process and what are the potential pitfalls for ensuring that a Psak Din does in fact become legally enforceable? The answer to these questions in a sentence is that a Psak Din is viewed by United States law as an arbitration award. Therefore, to the extent the Beis Din process conforms to arbitration law, the resulting Psak Din will be legally binding. Recognizing that there is likely a broad range of familiarity with arbitration in the audience, I'd like to begin by giving a little sketch of how arbitration works. In so doing, I will focus primarily on New York law, given that New York is where most Beis Din litigation takes place. You will see on your source sheets quotes from New York cases and statutes that are meant to give you a better sense of the law that we will be discussing. One important caveat: nothing I say today should be taken as legal advice. If you have specific questions about a particular case or a particular issue, you should consult, among others, an attorney. But I do hope today to highlight the issues you should be thinking about in such conversations. Also, I will try to leave as much time as possible for questions. So to begin, what exactly is arbitration? Simply put, arbitration is an adjudication of the dispute by person or persons selected by the parties. An agreement to arbitrate is usually incorporated as a provision in a contract. As an example, look at the bottom of page 2 of your source packets. There you will see an example of a standard arbitration clause, which selects individuals to adjudicate a dispute. This type of provision can be incorporated into a wide range of contracts to ensure that arbitration is the result of any controversy between the parties. Alternatively, you can have a standalone arbitration agreement, something that is much more common in the Beis Din context. People typically choose arbitration for a variety of reasons. First, procedures in arbitration as opposed to litigation in court are much more streamlined. Most notably, the more limited discovery procedures in arbitration are far less costly to the parties. Second, because of the more limited procedures, arbitration offers faster resolutions. And third, parties can use arbitration to select individuals to adjudicate their dispute who have particular expertise in a specific industry. Courts also like arbitration primarily because it helps relieve the stress on overburdened court dockets. But importantly, when parties sign a typical arbitration agreement, they are selecting a set of procedural rules to govern their dispute. They are not, however, selecting the substantive law that will govern the dispute. Instead, the law of the jurisdiction applies. Thus, if their dispute took place, for example, in New York, an arbitrator would, at least in theory, apply New York law when adjudicating the case. By contrast, this is not true when parties sign a based-in arbitration agreement. To understand why, look at the Befton of America sample arbitration agreement on pages 1 and 2 of your source packets. This is often referred to as a Starbewerin, or in American law, an arbitration agreement. The fourth and fifth paragraphs of the arbitration agreement are the actual arbitration provisions. Quote, for the purpose of satisfactorily adjudging said differences and disputes, it has been agreed by the said parties that the matters in dispute between them, touching the several contentions above mentioned, be submitted to the arbitration of the Befton of America, which shall resolve the matter in accordance with its rules and procedures. Said parties agree that they have selected the aforesaid Befton to resolve their disputes and shall accept the ruling of the arbitrators appointed by that organization as a binding decision. Through these provisions, the parties select the Befton of America to adjudicate the dispute. Now take a look at the sixth paragraph of the agreement. This is what is referred to as a choice of law provision. The parties acknowledge that the arbitrator may resolve the controversy in accordance with Jewish law, din, or through court-ordered settlement in accordance with Jewish law, shara krova l'din. This provision selects Jewish law, both procedural law and substantive law, to govern the adjudication of the dispute. By using these two provisions together, the shtar beirurin, unlike a typical arbitration agreement, selects both the individuals to adjudicate the dispute and the law that will govern the adjudication of the dispute. Okay, now you have a shtar beirurin. How do you go from a binding shtar beirurin to a legally enforceable based-in award? To better understand the process, I've constructed a hypothetical, which I'd like to use throughout today's presentation, that you can find in your source packets on page 3. Given Rabbi Willig's shiur just a few minutes ago, I probably should have chosen a plaintiff that starts with a P and a defendant that starts with a D, but I hope you'll excuse me. In 2008, Joe opens a pizza store on Main Street. He's always dreamed of opening a pizza store and invests all of his savings to do so. Because of Joe's limited resources, the store is small and doesn't have much capacity in terms of the amount of pizzas it can produce. As a result, to pay the rent, Joe's prices are a bit high. A year later, in 2009, Mike opens a pizza store two blocks down from Joe. Mike actually has some serious entrepreneurs financing his new pizza store. In turn, Mike's store is much bigger than Joe's and produces a lot more pizzas. Because of its higher volume, pizza at Mike's is much cheaper, but has less of the homemade taste that Joe's pizza has. A few months after Mike's store opens, Joe begins to see his profits plummet. Concerned that his store is going to go bankrupt, Joe decides to file a cause of action for Hasagas Gvul with the local Beis Din. By way of background and without going into too much detail, Hasagas Gvul prohibits individuals from unduly competing with already existing businesses when doing so will, and I use this as very much for shorthand, definitely damage the existing business. The rationale behind the rule is to protect businesses where the owner has already invested significant capital, capital that would be lost were the business to fail. Now, the first step in ensuring the legal enforceability of a psak din is to have both parties sign a binding arbitration agreement. Without both parties agreeing to arbitrate, a court cannot enforce the subsequent arbitration award. Therefore, after Joe files his cause of action, the Beis Din sends Mike a hazmana, informing Mike that he must sign an arbitration agreement and appear before the Beis Din to respond to Joe's complaint. As you can imagine, not everybody immediately agrees to sign an arbitration agreement as per a request of a Beis Din. So let's say in our pizza case, Mike initially refused to sign an arbitration agreement. Indeed, let's say even after the Beis Din sends the requisite 3 hazmana, Mike still refuses to appear. Under such circumstances, the Beis Din will send a letter warning Mike that if he continues to refuse to appear, it will issue a seiruv, or contempt order, which will cause him to suffer consequences within the Jewish community. Because of this threat, Mike signs the arbitration agreement and appears before the basin. Question: under United States law, is the arbitration agreement considered binding? The potential problem is that an agreement is not valid if signed under duress. And so the question becomes, does the Basin's threat of issuing the SAREV render the arbitration agreement unenforceable on account of duress? In answering this question, courts generally do not find the threat of a SAREV sufficiently significant so as to render an arbitration agreement so signed unenforceable on account of duress. As an example, consider Greenberg v. Greenberg in Source 1, a case heard by the New York Appellate Division Second Department in 1997. In this case, the petitioner, Dory Greenberg, brought a proceeding against her ex-husband seeking spousal support. In response to Dory's claim, Jacob Greenberg, Dory's ex-husband, made a motion to vacate all orders requiring that he make spousal support payments. His rationale was relatively straightforward. The two parties had signed an arbitration agreement agreeing to submit all their disputes to a Basin. As part of the Basin proceeding, both Dory and Jacob signed a release, discharging each other from, quote, all debts, dues, sums of money, judgments, claims, and demands in law, admiralty, or equity. Accordingly, Jacob argued that Dory had released him from all claims of spousal support. In response, Dory claimed that she signed the release under the threat that her failure to do so would prompt the issuance of a SAREV. She therefore claimed that the release was extracted under duress and was therefore not enforceable. In deciding the case, the court held that a threat of a SAREV was not sufficient to constitute duress. In so doing, it reasoned as follows, which again can be found in Source 1 of your packets. Quote, the threat of a SAREV, which entails a type of ostracism from the religious community and which is prescribed as an enforcement mechanism by the religious law to which the petitioner freely adheres, cannot be deemed duress. The record in the present case does not support a finding that the wife was subjected to any particular coercion greater than which is intrinsic in the case of any member of a religious community who, as a matter of conscience, feels obligated to obey the laws of his or her religious organization or to follow the decrees of a religious court, and who consequently exposes himself or herself to the ecclesiastical sanctions available for the enforcement of such decrees or such law. Thus, while courts recognize the force of a shtar seref, the shtar seref is not, under normal circumstances, enough to render an arbitration agreement coerced. Okay, so let's move to the next step. Once both parties have agreed to sign an arbitration agreement and appeared before the Basin, the Basin will hear evidence and testimony submitted by the parties. For example, in the pizza store case, Joe is likely to present evidence demonstrating the effect of Mike's store on the financial viability of his own store. After the hearing is complete, the Basin will issue a psak din, or an arbitration award. As an example, let's go back to the pizza store case. Let's say that the Basin issues an award requiring Mike to pay for the damage he has done to Joe's store. What must Joe do with the award in order to make it legally enforceable? In New York, to make a psak din legally enforceable, Joe must move to confirm the award in New York Supreme Court. By way of background, just to make sure everybody's on the same playing field, New York Supreme Court in New York is the lowest court. Then comes the Appellate Division, then comes New York Court of Appeals. I think almost everybody signed up for CLD, so I assume everybody knew that, just in case. So you move to confirm an award in New York Supreme Court. Unfortunately, quite a number of parties, after securing an award in Basin, failed to confirm the award, probably because there's a sense that, of course, the party will comply with the award of the Basin. I cannot stress how important it is in jurisdictions like New York to make such a motion. If you look at CPLR 7510 in Source 3 of your packets, you will notice that a party only has 1 year to make such a motion. Therefore, if you wait more than a year, New York courts will no longer confirm the award. Under such circumstances, from the perspective of U.S. law, the psak din is no longer worth the paper it's written on. I emphasize the importance of moving to confirm an award because I have heard too many heart-wrenching stories from individuals who have failed to do so, specifically in the marital context. I think one of the most poignant stories I heard, I once gave a lecture on this topic, and a woman approached me after I finished and told me how she had, after many years, been able to get her husband to appear before a Basin in order to adjudicate some disputes regarding spousal support. The Basin issued an award granting her a variety of alimony payments, which she desperately needed. After the din Torah, for the first year, the woman began receiving her payments, and she thought all was well. Once the year was up, the payments stopped. At this point, she contacted an attorney because she had been told the psak din is legally enforceable. The attorney explained to her what I've been explaining to you thus far. Once the year is up, the psak din is worthless. from the perspective of United States law, just to make that clear. If you take anything away from today's presentation, I beg you, please remember that receiving the Psoctin is not the last stop in the Basin litigation process. Now, just as the party who wins in Basin can move to confirm the award, the party losing in Basin can challenge the confirmation of an award and ask a court to vacate, or what that means is void, the Psoctin. Question. When courts review a motion to confirm an award or a motion to vacate an award, what are they looking for? To understand the principle here, we have to remember that arbitration is not treated as a judicial decision, but as a contract. Therefore, courts are not really looking at the award in order to evaluate the underlying merits. The arbitration is something the parties agree to, and a review of the merits would undermine the very purpose of arbitration. Thus, as you can see in source 4 of your packets, courts defer to an arbitrator's factual findings, interpretations of contracts, and judgments concerning remedies. Using the pizza store case again, a court will not revisit issues like the monetary effect of Mike's pizza store on Joe's bottom line. Along these lines, courts grant wide deference to arbitrators to craft a remedy. As the New York Court of Appeals has explained, quote, in the final analysis, arbitrators may do justice, and the award may well reflect the spirit rather than the letter of the agreement. Furthermore, according to the Court of Appeals, even in circumstances when an arbitrator makes errors of law or fact, courts will not assume the role of overseers to confirm the award to their sense of justice. For example, in the late 1970s, the Rochester Teachers Association took the Rochester City School District to arbitration over a dispute regarding sabbatical leaves. Pursuant to Section 34.5 of the Collective Bargaining Agreement between the parties, quote, regularly appointed teachers who have served for 5 years may, upon the recommendation of the superintendent and with the approval of the board, be granted leave of absence for study or travel upon certain conditions. During the 1972-73 school year, in accordance with this provision, 36 teachers applied for sabbatical leave. In each case, the teacher received a form letter which stated, quote, your application has been considered, but as an economy measure, among other reasons, the superintendent of schools is not recommending to the Board of Education your request for sabbatical leave for the 1973-74 school year. The teachers filed a grievance, arguing that they were improperly denied sabbatical leaves. The school district responded by noting that the provision for sabbatical leaves was discretionary. The rule simply stated that the superintendent may grant sabbatical leaves. Dissatisfied, the Teachers Association demanded arbitration as per the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. At the close of the arbitration proceedings, the arbitrator found that the school district's denial of sabbatical leave violated the terms of the collective bargaining agreement. In reaching this conclusion, the arbitrator recognized the discretionary nature of the provision, but noted, among other findings, that the sabbatical provision had first been adopted by the parties in a 1965 collective bargaining agreement. And since that time, quote, even when the district had been in the throes of financial crisis, sabbatical leaves were consistently and uniformly granted under the terms of the provision. Thus, looking to the past practice followed by the parties to find intent, the arbitrator concluded that it was contemplated that the school district would be bound to grant some sabbatical leaves despite financial difficulties. The school district then filed a motion to vacate the award, arguing that the arbitrator had exceeded his authority by failing to read the sabbatical leave provision of the collective bargaining agreement as discretionary. This, of course, had lots of appeal. In fact, it does say, the provision did say, may grant sabbatical leaves. The New York Court of Appeals, this provision notwithstanding, denied the school district's motion and confirmed the arbitration award. As part of its analysis, the court explained that, quote, obviously, it was not irrational for the arbitrator to conclude that the party's conduct in the past, under similar agreements, demonstrated their intent or expectations. There was, as noted, uncontradicted proof that despite financial difficulties, the school district had consistently and publicly granted sabbatical leaves. Thus, it was not unreasonable to find that by renewing the agreement, the parties intended to continue the practice followed in the past. In this way, the Rochester School District case highlights the broad deference afforded arbitrators in interpreting contracts and crafting remedies. In reviewing motions to confirm and motions to vacate awards, courts are not looking to rehash the merits of the case. Instead, they are primarily looking for defenses that indicate whether there were fundamental problems with the fairness of the arbitration. For example, look at the statutory grounds for vacature listed in CPLR 7511 in source 7 of your packets. Number seven. For the most part, these grounds focus not on the merits of the dispute, but on fundamental problems with the fairness of the arbitration. Returning to our pizza store case, let's say it turned out that one of the members of the Basin was Joe's uncle. Or better, let's say there was a witness who had previously heard one of the Dianas saying, "I hate Mike's pizza store. His pizza is so commercial. But the price is driving Joe out of business. I can't let that happen because I love Joe's pizza." That type of evidence would be relevant if Mike filed a motion to vacate an award. Similarly, as you can see again in Source 7, under CPLR 7511B14, the very last piece of that source, an arbitration award, and in turn a PSOC DIN, can be vacated if some of the procedural protections afforded by the New York arbitration statute are not followed. And an example of such a protection, which must be afforded parties to arbitration, can be found in Source 8, which is the right to counsel. If a basin denies one of the parties the right to counsel, that party can later move to have the PSOC DIN vacated on that ground. Moreover, as per CPLR 7506D, while a party may represent himself in an arbitration, he may not waive the right to counsel. Interestingly, such a case was actually decided this past November by the Kings County Supreme Court. In Kahan v. Rosner, the court addressed a case where siblings submitted a dispute to a basin by signing an arbitration that contained an interesting provision. Quote, "We also accepted upon ourselves to bring only such rabbinical counsel who is acceptable to the rabbinical court. And if we appear at the rabbinical court without rabbinical counsel, we do so by our own desire." During the lead-up to the Din Torah, one of the parties, Joseph, requested to be represented by a particular attorney, a request the basin denied. Upon having his attorney rejected, Joseph decided to represent himself. After losing in the Din Torah, Joseph made a motion to vacate the award on a number of grounds, including that he had been refused the right to counsel. The court found in Joseph's favor and vacated the award, noting that the right to counsel must be, quote, construed broadly. Therefore, the court held that in denying Joseph's request to be represented by a particular attorney, the basin had, in effect, asked Joseph to waive his right to counsel in violation of CPLR 7506. As a result, the court vacated the basin's award. The decision in this case was somewhat surprising, given that there had been no explicit waiver of the right to counsel. But the court, seeking to ensure the basic procedural integrity of the arbitration, refused to confirm the award. This case is a cautionary tale for Batei Din in taking the utmost care in complying with New York's arbitration law if it hopes to have its awards confirmed. I would also note that a party should always consult with a halachic authority before making a motion to vacate an award. While most poskim see no issue in making a motion to confirm an award in secular court, making a motion to vacate an award, thereby trying to render a psak din void, might very well run afoul of the Issur HaKos. Under New York law, there are also a couple of additional grounds for vacating awards that do, to some degree, implicate the merits of the underlying decision. The first is where courts vacate an award for quote-unquote irrationality. As you can imagine, this ground for vacature is notoriously vague. Importantly, it is rarely used by courts because it goes to the merits of the case, something which courts typically do not want to do. However, in extreme circumstances, courts will do so. As an example, look at Source 10 in your source packets. In that case, the arbitrators found that facts that were contradicted by both parties. While courts won't re-examine the merits, such a showing where both parties agree to X and an arbitrator finds not X would simply be too much for a court, and under such circumstances, it's very likely that a court would vacate an award as irrational. Thus, applying such a case to our pizza store hypothetical, let's say instead of awarding Joe damages, the basin decided to award Mike damages based on the theory that Mike's store was really open first. A court might vacate a PSOC DIN as irrational if it turned out that both parties, both Joe and Mike, agreed in the Din Torah that Joe's store was open first. That might constitute irrationality. Another ground for vacating an arbitration award is public policy. As you can see in Source 9 of your source packets, the New York Court of Appeals has explained, quote, "A court may vacate an arbitral award where strong and well-defined policy considerations embodied in constitutional, statutory, or common law prohibit a particular matter from being decided or certain relief from being granted by an arbitrator. This rule stems from the general principle that contracts are void when they violate public policy. For example, a contract hiring an assassin is void on the grounds of public policy. You can't do what the law prohibits simply because you put it in a contract. Similarly, an arbitration panel cannot issue a decision that violates a well-defined public policy. However, if a public policy is going to void a contract or vacate an arbitration award, it must absolutely prohibit, quote unquote, the conduct in question. Therefore, again, in the words of the New York Court of Appeals quoted in Source 9, a court, however, may not vacate an award on public policy grounds when vague or attenuated considerations of a general public interest are at stake. However, despite these limitations on its application, the public policy exception can cause serious problems for a basin. One of the most notable examples is cases of child custody. Child custody determinations in New York must comply both with the Child Support Standards Act and must be in the best interests of the child. Importantly, courts have an independent obligation to promote the best interests of the child. This application of the public policy exception causes a problem for a basin trying to resolve a divorce where the parties want all issues resolved simultaneously. There is no guarantee that a court will enforce a child custody determination made by a basin because it has an independent obligation to evaluate the best interests of the child for itself. As an example, consider Source 11 in your source packets. In Hirsch v. Hirsch, the Appellate Division's Second Department considered a psak din that both divided a couple's assets and rendered a child custody determination. The court found that the award should be vacated for a variety of reasons, including public policy. First, the Beis Din required the wife to withdraw a pending criminal complaint against her husband. Such an award violated public policy because, quote, an arbitration award that deprives a party of a constitutional right to seek redress or protection in a civil or criminal matter is against public policy. Second, and importantly for our discussion of child custody, the court found that the psak din violated public policy both by failing to require a husband's visitation to be supervised and, maybe more shockingly, by only requiring the husband to pay $457 a month as support for his 6 children. By contrast, family court had required payments of $340 a week. As is clear from the decision, the court was deeply critical of the Beis Din's award, finding that such an award would severely undermine the best interests of the children. As a result, it vacated the psak din. However, it's important to note that some jurisdictions are more hospitable to Beis Din awards as to child custody. These types of jurisdictional distinctions are something you would want to reason with an attorney before submitting a child custody dispute to a Beis Din. Another important example where the public policy exception comes into play is Hasagas Gvul cases. Consider again our pizza store case. Let's say the Beis Din, in its award, requires Mike to close the store because it was unduly competing with Joe's store. Such an award would very possibly run afoul of both federal and state antitrust statutes because it is aimed at stifling business competition. As a result, such a decision would likely not be enforced by a court because it violates the antitrust public policy. Another set of potential problems for Piske Din comes from the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, which, as you can see in point 5 of the source packet, prohibits government from, quote, making a law respecting the establishment of religion. The Establishment Clause has been interpreted to, among other things, prohibit a court from becoming, quote unquote, excessively entangled with religion. What constitutes excessive entanglement is a deeply contested issue. But one set of cases that clearly constitutes excessive entanglement is cases where a court, in reaching a decision, would have to interpret and apply religious doctrine. As an example, consider a contractual dispute between an Orthodox shul and an Orthodox rabbi. Let's say the rabbi has a lifetime contract, which allows him to be fired, but only for cause. However, what constitutes cause is never explicitly defined in the contract. Now, let's assume the shul terminates the rabbi for cause, claiming that the rabbi is simply no longer fulfilling his responsibilities, while the rabbi, not surprisingly, claims that there is no cause for his termination. For a court to adjudicate such a case would require determining what the responsibilities of an Orthodox rabbi are. and making such a determination would very likely require a court to become excessively entangled with religion. Thus, a court would have to dismiss the case on Establishment Clause grounds. Question. Should the Establishment Clause prohibit courts from confirming Pisgay Din on the theory that doing so would require a court to become excessively entangled with religion? Courts have not applied the Establishment Clause in this way. This makes sense given what we have said so far about the standard for reviewing arbitration awards. Courts do not look at the merits of the underlying dispute, and instead, all they do is make sure that there has not been any sort of procedural unfairness in the arbitration proceedings. Therefore, they do not need to apply religious doctrine in order to confirm a Psak Din. Returning to our pizza store case, the court does not have to decide whether the Beis Din correctly applied the Jewish doctrine of Hasagas Gevul. It must merely make sure that there has not been some sort of procedural unfairness in the arbitration. For this reason, there are a number of instances where while the Establishment Clause would prohibit a court from adjudicating the case itself, it would still allow the court to confirm a Psak Din addressing the very same issue. As an example, consider a recent New Jersey case from only a couple of weeks ago, Abdul Haq v. Jewish Press. The case involved a claim for professional defamation stemming from an erroneous publishing of a plaintiff's name in the Jewish Press's Seirav listing. The plaintiff claimed that, as an Orthodox fertility doctor, his business was harmed by the perception that a Seirav had been issued against him because his client base was largely Orthodox Jews. The defendant, the Jewish Press, claimed that deciding the case would require the court to become excessively entangled with religion, and therefore argued that the court should dismiss the case on Establishment Clause grounds. The court agreed with the Jewish Press and dismissed the case. What this decision meant is that even if the plaintiff was wrongfully harmed by the erroneous printing of his name on the Seirav list, he could not seek redress in court. While I myself am somewhat skeptical of the court's decision, the case does highlight one of the advantages of going to Beis Din. Had the case been submitted to a Din Torah, the Beis Din could have adjudicated the dispute. In turn, and ironically, the very same New Jersey court that could not have heard the case because of the Establishment Clause could have granted a motion confirming an arbitration award addressing the very same claim. In this way, taking a case to Beis Din often serves as an Establishment Clause screen to allow for adjudication of disputes that implicate significant religious issues. In say this, I would like to note one caveat. To the extent courts expand their review of Pisgay Din for irrationality, delving into the underlying facts, the process of confirming an award could run into Establishment Clause problems. Thus, if a judge believes that he should reinvestigate the merits of a Psak Din to truly determine whether the award is rational, he may become excessively entangled with religion. However, so long as courts remain true to the limited rationality review required by the law, Pisgay Din should not and have not required such excessive entanglement with religion. And with that, I'd like to open the floor for questions.
I'm sure the answer is complicated. I'm wondering about challenges to choice of a Beis Din on substantive and procedural unconscionability grounds, in particular on grounds that Beis Din procedures are procedurally unconscionable, and the body of law to be applied, halakha, is substantively unconscionable, judged by secular law standards, and in particular case, say, family law or some other issues. Is that issue decided, or what's the...
It has not been decided. You've hit upon one of the topics of my dissertation, and we're now going to be here for another hour. Let me try to be short about this. Unconscionability, for those who aren't familiar, typically requires demonstrating two components. One is procedural unconscionability, which actually has nothing to do with procedures. Procedural unconscionability is the way in which somebody has been kind of pressured into signing an arbitration agreement. And then you also need, typically, substantive unconscionability. Something in the arbitration agreement was somehow unconscionable, somehow deeply unfair, offends our very basic notions of justice. So to make such a showing, you'd have to do both things. Now here's where the problem starts. Unconscionability is a ground for voiding an arbitration agreement, not vacating an arbitration award. Now, this might sound like, what's the big deal? The big deal kind of runs like this, and we're going to need a little bit more background. The standard kind of arbitration fact pattern, it'll be incorporated, let's say, into a contract. Let's take an employment contract. Some school teacher X signs up with school Y, they have an arbitration agreement, they have an employment agreement, and in there, there's that provision, like the one we saw on page 2. And so, at the end of his, he doesn't know it's the end of his employment, but all of a sudden, he's fired for a cause, or whatever happens, the teacher is fired after many years. Now, in that circumstance, when it comes time for he goes and sues the school, obviously, because he thinks he was wrongfully terminated, what happens at that time is, the question will be, well, the school will say, well, we have to go to arbitration now because we have this arbitration provision in our contract. And the teacher might say at that point, I was pressured into going to arbitration. Now, you see how in the normal fact pattern, somebody will claim pressure when at the very first suggestion of going to arbitration, as opposed to later on in the case, because he typically has that opportunity because he's not signing an arbitration agreement at the very same time as somebody suggesting he go to arbitration. Basin litigation typically works very differently. You sign an arbitration agreement post-dispute, right? You have a dispute, and then you say, what do we do with our dispute now? Let's sign arbitration agreements. Now, the argument here is you have to have some showing that you're pressured into arbitration. And that pressure would come at the very moment that you're signing the arbitration agreement. So the question is, given this different fact pattern, when would you raise the claim of unconscionability? Typically, you have to raise it initially. You can't participate in an arbitration proceeding and then claim that your basis for doing so, the agreement, was void.
Why is it a defense?
I'm sorry?
Why is it a defense?
Why does he need a defense?
Why is it a defense then?
Well, it works typically when you have at the outset, meaning at the outset you can claim I was pressured into the contracts of adhesion model. I was pressured into the arbitration, and lo and behold, the rules of the arbitration might say something like, I don't get any discovery, which in an employment context will often need to prove that you were employed or anything like that. In the based-in context, it becomes more problematic because you'll typically only find out about all the elements of the...
Suppose he refuses to participate in the arbitration.
He refuses. How does he make it?
I mean, which... In other types of arbitration context, happens all the time.
So he makes it at the outset.
So he puts in an arbitration answer that says, I do not believe the arbitrator has jurisdiction over...
Well, has he signed an arbitration agreement?
Well, that's the question, isn't it? Has he signed a valid arbitration?
No. I'm not asking valid. Just, in fact, has he put his name on a piece of paper?
Because you're saying in the base thing context, he would...
Typically do it post-dispute. Now, if there were, because you see, in that context, he's never going to have signed it if he's arguing that he doesn't have to go.
Well, there's two religious litigants who put an arbitration clause
in a contract. So I have a particular view as to this matter, and I think the way we should deal with these problems is you also need the substantive element of unconscionability, right? Something in the process needs to go wrong. Typically, the problem with based-in arbitration agreements, it's not a problem. It'll say Jewish law applies. Who knows what that means? There are a million views as to what Jewish law is going to be applied. You don't know. For example, under the most kind of old school, middle aged, I don't want to refer to it as draconian, but let's say, I don't think Bate didn't function this way. Let's say one basin decides that that means that women don't get to testify. But it doesn't say that in the arbitration agreement. It just says Jewish law applies, right? So you might not know that when you show up. You might only find out when your star witness goes up to the stand and they say, sorry, this isn't going to count. Now you're stuck, right? Because now you've participated in the proceedings. The substance of unconscionability comes 3 days into the proceedings. You might have been pressured into it, but have you waived your unconscionability claim? Because it's not a ground for vacating the award, the problem is you can't make the claim after the arbitration is done. I'm of the view that when, for example, federal courts refer to timely motions for waiver, or you kind of get up and say something at that point, that would be sufficient to preserve the claim. I'm not aware of any cases deciding it, and if that came up, that would be my argument. But I'm definitely not aware of any instances where that has been kind of, courts have noted the way in which religious arbitration functions differently, understood that timeliness is different given when you're signing the arbitration agreement, and in turn, when you would have to make the claim. And also the vagueness of kind of saying Jewish law applies. Other arbitration agreements will typically have a very clear provision about what discovery is, and a court can evaluate it, whether or not the provision in the contract is unconscionable. That's the kind of the nub of the problem with unconscionability in this context. I'm sympathetic to using it, but I'm not aware of a single court of reported case in the United States where in the religious arbitration context, unconscionability has been successfully marshaled to vacate an award or void an arbitration.
Thank you. What about other equitable principles such as mistake? say the Bet-Din specifically awarded, in your employment example, front pay, back pay, and a few other things, and in totaling up the numbers, they forgot to include the front pay, and nobody knows.
Well, I think mistake, I mean, you have options under mistake. I mean, you can typically even go back to the arbitrators for a mistake, and if there's a mistake in an agreement, I think you'll often have statutory grounds for redress. I think that poses a little bit less of a problem to the extent the statutes and law and the jurisdiction allow for that. I think it would be okay. I suspect, you know, addition problems are more easily dealt with.
If you submit that to the Bezel of America, get submitted on appeal, and an appellate jurisdiction will deal with it in the Bezel of America. Yeah. It's right in the procedure.
Well, these goes, this is Rabbi Warburg, one of the mainstays of the Bezel of America.
The 1 year problem simply, could the disappointed wife with the 1 year confirmation problem have simply gone back to the Vestin to get a reconfirmation of the award and then take back the state?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit of a problem. We'll talk about the Bethan. The Bethan of America boilerplate arbitration agreement, you'll notice, also has a provision that says the Vestin only retains jurisdiction for 1 year. So.
Has that been ruled upon?
What? I'm sorry.
It sounds to me that that may be a problematic commodity agreement. Has that been ruled upon?
When you say problematic in terms, just to clarify, when you say it's problematic in terms of what, the retaining jurisdiction for only 1 year?
No, it's not the retaining jurisdiction for 1 year. It's that you can force them to come back in that year if the award was granted. Has that been ruled upon? Do the courts uphold that provision?
I'm not aware of any cases dealing with the problem that the basin retains jurisdiction for 1 year. You're saying within that year. There's a very well-known case.
In other words, they came out with a decision, and after they came out with a decision, they, sua sponte, they changed their decision within 1 year. Has that been ruled upon?
I'll say the following. There's a very well-known case, Mizell's v. Orr in the New York Court of Appeals, which dealt with... I'm sorry?
It's the opposite.
Okay. Sure about that? In New York Court of Appeals, it was Orr v. Mizell's?
Yeah.
All right. There you go. So what am I going to tell you? You know, the case. Very good. Okay, great. Oh, you want me to...
I want you to answer that.
I suspect, then, we'll talk in shorthand then.
Yeah.
I suspect then that the 1 year within the Basin of America's contract would be treated the same way the New York Court of Appeals dealt with the... There was no limitation in that case. And what the Court of Appeals required is a certain amount of definiteness to the initial award, but the ability to retain jurisdiction was limited to the Basin's ability to decide certain issues in terms of enforcing the original award. From the dicta in Orr v. Mizell's or Mizell's v. Orr, from the dicta in that case, it sounds like that if an arbitration panel or Basin would not be able to continuously go back without any justification. What are you pointing to?
It says the arbitrator shall retain jurisdiction of this matter for 1 year after it publishes its award, and they shall be authorized to modify the award for any reason they deem proper.
Right.
It seems like it gives you that jurisdiction.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't think any court has dealt with this matter, but I suspect that because an award has to be definite when it's issued, as per the CPLR, it would not be possible to have an award that is so indefinite that allowed modification any time, and therefore...
Then you change.
Well, it's hard to see how an award is definite if there's real jurisdiction to modify it at any time.
Okay.
So I suspect that that's how a court would deal with it.
Sure. That if you don't confirm it within 1 year, okay, then you're totally out. There's a split between the first department and the second department if you can use it defensively. So, for example...
Right.
If it was ruled to something, and now you're suing me in landlord-tenant court, I can state and go back and say, well, we had a ruling even though I didn't confirm the award.
No, that's correct. Again, in the context I was particularly harping on is kind of the marital context, where a woman is seeking spousal support as a plaintiff. And therein you have these particular problems where, unfortunately, people don't know to move to confirm an award. And under such circumstances, anybody who gets a base in stock, I believe, should immediately consult an attorney and then try to decide exactly what the ramifications of when they file.
Procedurally, what is the way to initiate the motion to confirm the award if there's some complaint?
You just make a motion. You file motion papers. There's a venue provision in the CPLR to let you know exactly where you should be making the motion. But you file a motion with the award and the arbitration agreement. Usually that's all you need.
Yeah,
you make a notice. Notice of motion. Everybody now. Go ahead.
How do you protect yourself with an arbitration award in case public policy or irrationality changes over time within that first year? For example, if, let's say...
Pass a statute. Pass a statute, for example.
Well, they pass a statute. I'm being more specific. Let's say you had an agreement regarding violation of kashrus with those restaurants, and they want to close it down. You say they didn't do anything wrong. And it's a matter of, let's say, something minor as opposed to, like, the way you're washing your vegetables, or as they might consider to be at some point.
They being the basin in this case?
When you want to vacate, when the other side, the losing side, wants to vacate the award later on, so they'll say, they'll go to court maybe at some point in time and say that, well, this is really stupid, this is irrational, or something as far as public policy is concerned, like let's say they're talking about shechita, and then they decide, you know, shechita is, all the petty people come out and they say this is terrible and stuff like that. So now it is possible that your original arbitration award could be vacated by a change in public policy or rationality.
If you had in the interim a change in public policy, I think the easiest example, just kind of a statute is passed at a certain point within the year prior to you making a motion to confirm the award. We have a very active audience. Maybe somebody here has a different view. I'm not aware of any such case ever coming up where the public policy changes in the middle. I don't have a strong intuition about how a court would decide such a case. I suspect that the court would not confirm the award because at the time that you make the motion to confirm, there's a public policy that requires them not to confirm the award.
And what about on that? What about the case you mentioned before that the Besdin, let's say, picks this quote draconian situation where they say that
I resisted using the word draconian.
Well, okay, that they won't allow the woman to testify, and then it comes for confirmation or vacating. They say, "What are you crazy?"
Right.
You know,
well, again, I think in that circumstance, you could potentially, given that improper discovery procedures is something already used by courts as an element of substantive unconscionability. Most notably in California, and I guess not surprisingly. And along those lines, you could potentially have that fill in as the element of substantive unconscionability, and then you would need a procedural unconscionability. You also need to show that you were pushed into it. So you're pushed in, and then there was a problem. I think then you could make out the elements of unconscionability, again, subject to the waiver issues we were discussing before.
Let's take a situation where you don't have a threat of a serve, but a serve that actually issues.
Mm-hmm.
As a result, one against whom the serve was issued now goes to Besdin. He gets an award which is advantageous to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
He now moves to vacate the award on the grounds that it was under duress.
Mm-hmm.
Does the Besdin then have to take into consideration the religious ramifications of the serve, and therefore have to wash, does the court have to take into consideration the religious ramifications of the serve, and then under the First Amendment simply say you can't handle the case?
I'm not sure, and again, I think this is an example here of it would depend, and all we're talking about, just to make clear, there have been some interesting cases recently with serifs. I just want to make sure what we're talking about. There's an issuance of a serif for
refusing
refusing to come.
Right. Not a threat, but
okay.
The serif is actually issued. In order to get rid of the serif, he now goes to Besdin.
And he goes and they render a determination.
They render a decision.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Motion is made to confirm. He says, I'm going to vacate.
Yeah.
The only reason why I went to Besdin is under duress.
Mm-hmm. So he wants to vacate the award on the grounds of duress?
Correct. Because the serif has already issued.
Right.
Not a threat of the serif.
Yeah.
Serif has already issued.
Again, I don't see, again, based on precedent out there, while I understand that there might be some courts and people who think that the kind of the mere conversation about religious issues might implicate the Establishment Clause. New Jersey appears to have a very wide reading of the Establishment Clause, which I think is not the best reading in the world. I suspect that in cases like this, the way it ought to work is the mere threat of a serif is not deemed as a sufficient threat to constitute duress. Either a threat of it or the serif itself. All it is a function, as we were reading ourselves just a few moments ago, all it is a way in which religious groups enforce their own communities. And again, the intuition of New York courts on this is that that's not something that the state should be taking into account. All that is if you want to participate in this religious community, then these are the terms, but you don't have to. You can just walk away. And under those circumstances, it appears courts are not sympathetic to a duress defense, even, I would suspect.
I don't
see why that would make a difference. I'm not going to be able to take any more questions. I have a flight to catch. So thank you very much.
Good job. That is the single most creative excuse for not sending any more questions.
Okay.
So it's all in the